Welcome. I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. We are going to enter into a simultaneous public hearing today on four bills. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1585, 4013, 4014, and 4015. The purpose of that is because we have some educators here who are going to testify on 1585, but also given their depth of expertise, they can also weigh in on things like best practices and reporting and lead poisoning. So let's begin with Senator Devlin, Oregon State University President Ed Ray, and Portland Community College President Preston Pulliam. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I hope that you will indulge me this morning. I'm Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I will be speaking for a little bit longer than I normally do before a committee. So with that, I will get started. Like you, I believe in the importance of supporting and protecting education in our state. During the 2011 session, I, along with my House co-chairs in Ways and Means, made it a priority to lock the K-12 school budget in as early as possible. As we all know, that budget was not adequate, but the best that we could do with the funds that we had available, so I think what we tried to do was to provide certainty. In fact, our hope was that by doing this, we could give our public schools stable funding for the 2011-2013 biennium, something that we haven't done since the 2005 biennium. I believe that it is vitally important to continue to provide this level of stability to our students and our schools. However, there has been insufficient funding available to restore the 3.5% holdback from higher education, community colleges, or Head Start. Unfortunately, protecting education funding can no longer be done if we continue some of the trends that have been in place since 2003. Since 2003, in the legislatively adopted budget, K through 12 community colleges and higher education at that time accounted for 58% of general fund lottery fund spending. In the 2011-13 legislatively adopted budget, K through 12 community colleges and higher education and affiliated other education expenditures barely exceed 50% of total funding. In fact, as we make some last-minute adjustments to this budget, they may, for the first time in a long time, actually go under the 50% mark by a tenth of a point or so. You would say, then, well, what has basically happened? Well, since 2003, if you wanted to look at this positively without any reference point, you would say that state funding for education had increased by 15%, not adjusted for inflation. But let me give you another reference point. In that same period of time, since 2003, public safety spending has increased by 53% in this state, in the general fund lottery fund budget. Human services has actually increased by 64%. So you can see in pretty clear illustration why education funding has dropped from the 58 to 50. Now, I'm not here to argue that it should be 52 or 54 or 56 or 58. What I'm here to argue is that we cannot afford for it to drop any further. There are some that might say that we could just wait until the economy was to recover. The problem with this is our recovery is going to be very slow. And if we continue to make choices that give education a smaller and smaller portion of the pie, we're going to fall below a funding level that will even minimally meet our needs. While many have treated our most recent forecast like it was good news, in actuality is a confirmation that we are in a very slow recovery. As you can see from the spreadsheet I have distributed, you should have a copy of it. It's the one with all the numbers that go from one side of the page to the other. In December of 2009, we forecasted general fund lottery fund resources for 2013 at almost $18 billion. We now forecast those same resources in this March forecast at close to $15.7 billion, a $2.3 billion decline in slightly more than 2 years. Some will say that the remaining increase is adequate even if we continue our current practices. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Many of us fully expect our 2013-15 forecast may still fall by the time we come into session in 2013. Built into this forecast are a number of state tax credits that will probably not sunset, many of them that you will not want to sunset and I will not want to sunset. And they are factored into this forecast, and if they do not sunset, the forecast will be even less. We have actually tried to the greatest extent possible to minimize the use of one-time revenue in the 2011-13 budget. However, there is still a substantial use of one-time revenue. That means literally whatever that number is, you should be taking several hundred millions of dollars off of that number. And if you're going to leave any kind of a prudent ending fund balance, the number will be much lower than most people anticipate. This bill sets a floor, not a ceiling, for education funding. SB 1585 would require that at least 50% of the general fund lottery fund dollars in the legislatively adopted budget and actual budget go towards K through 12 community colleges, higher education, and the other areas that are listed in the bill. I know we all believe in the importance of education, and we know that it must be adequately funded. And all of us are committed to providing the best educational opportunities for our citizens. However, Oregon is suffering a disconnect between its education rhetoric and its funding reality. There is such a vast difference between what we talk about in terms of what our plans are for education and in terms of what priorities we actually put on education as we are determining our budgets for now and in the future. I wanted to take a moment specifically to discuss some of your school districts because I know you're all well aware of some of the impacts in your school districts. And some of them are somewhat mixed, but I'm just going to highlight a few. Senator Haas, Mr. Chairman, you know that in the 2011 school year, your school district cut $22 million in expenditures and almost 140 employees, shortening the school by 4 days. Your school districts will also face probably an additional, much more significant cut in this coming year based upon what our appropriation is.
It's 40 million.
Yeah. Senator Morris, your school district, one of the best managed in the state, I should say, Greater Albany, had approximately about a 5% cut and cut 20 personnel. And it actually had to close some schools. I'm not necessarily against closing schools if it makes economic sense or if it actually leads to better education. And I can't say what particularly happened here, but if the schools were closed simply just to consolidate kids and to warehouse kids in larger buildings, then there may be some issues there.
That happened, Mr. Chair.
If Senator Beyer was here, Springfield School District cut 145 staff in the 2008-2009 school year, cut over actually 11% of their staff. They're also closing a number of schools. In Senator George's district and in the Newburg district, they went from a relatively high number for kindergarten through third grade of 1 to 23, which is actually a high number. As you know, being education, you know that's a high number. They went to 1 to 26 for kindergarten's first and second graders. Portland Public Schools, Senator Steiner Hayward, cut $20 million budget reduction, 236%, six positions. In reality, school districts all over the state in the last 3 to 4 years have cut over 4,000 positions, many of them teachers, and some of them support personnel. I would hate to give you the comparisons in state government because they would be kind of something you wouldn't want to note. In the 2009 biennium, I think our net was to cut about 200 positions. Through a lot of efforts and with the approval of members of the legislature and the governor, we cut somewhat over 1,000 staff members in our current budget in terms of vacancies. And as you know, I'm currently running into some difficulties cutting a few more middle managers out of state government. The situation is not that much better when you get to community colleges on my left or higher ed on my right. Community colleges between 2007 and 2011 have had a 21% cut in their funding, from about $500 million to $395 million. At the same time, community colleges' full-time equivalency have went from 94,000 students to over 124,000 students. Oregon's university have experienced a substantial decrease in general fund support. In 2007 biennium, their funding was at about $847 million. In 2011, it's at $669 million. I don't even have it in my notes, but many of you have been involved in the shared responsibility model and the Oregon Opportunity Grant. That program is just a shell of what it used to be. It used to be thought of as a way that we could get the people, not the lowest of income that we're still able to address, but middle-income parents the capability for their kids to go to school. It's barely serving, not really even serving, the needs of the lowest income. In fact, in many cases, it's not doing as well as our former program did. It is no longer anybody can attend who's qualified. We capped it. We've had to cap it. Its grant is much lower than anyone ever anticipated it would be. And that's the basic situation that we are in. What I would like to say in conclusion, and then I just wanted to say a couple of things quickly, is no matter what budget you look at, our education funding is not keeping with our needs. I don't want to suggest there aren't real needs in public safety and health and human services, because there are. I deal with them every day. You do also. But we need to make some very tough choices. We've made tough choices in the last biennium and this biennium, and we need to make some tougher choices if we're to maintain at least a barely adequate level of funding for education. One of the things I'd like to highlight here, you know, Representative Richardson and I do not agree on everything. I think that might surprise you. But one of the things he asked to have produced was a little document that shows all the new programs we've created and all the improvements in programs that we have done since 2007. It's interesting, the numbers are pretty big. In education, it takes about a page and a half to describe them. It's about $131 million in new funding. And they're good programs. I don't mean they're bad programs. There are increases in Head Start. There are a lot of things all of us would support. In human services, the increases in new programs is $276 million. And many of those things are good, actually, also. That's significant increasing in staffing at the state hospital. That's better payment for DD providers. There's just a whole bunch of things there. In public safety, it's $96 million. And that's largely due to Measure 57. Over half of it is Measure 57, which was an initiative. But you can see how mixed our priorities are. I often get asked in this thing, why can't I just take another $10 million off the state school fund? Or why can't I just take another $5 million out of higher ed or community colleges? This is about 200 pages long. This lists in great detail every one of the potential cuts in the 3.5, 3.5, 3.5. Nobody's doing all of this. This represents about $1.4 billion in cuts. But my two colleagues here to the left and the right, theirs are described similarly. Everything down to a $100,000 cut in here is described in quite a bit of detail. On page 12 of one of these, this is the description. If you indulge me, it will only take me a second. I've spent a lot of time with these. Page 12, State School Fund. It's a single line. It's a single line. This is what 3.5% represents. State School Fund, if we were to cut an additional 3.5%. $187 million general fund, $13 million lottery fund, $200 million. The only explanation I have in here is it that reduces the direct financial support to school districts. That's the entire explanation of what the impact of it is. The reality is there used to be the days here, and then we got a little bit of that today, when students filled the building and clamored for more funding. And most of our discussion was whether funding was going to be at 5.4 or 5.7 or at 5.7 or 6.2 when we were at 6.2. But there was not a great deal of discussion about what the individual impact is in each school district or each community college or each university. Somehow, we have to get so we understand those details better. I have an incredibly good, great staff, both my legislative assistant and in LFO. I have 1.5 FTE for the education area in LFO. I have 2 FTE for all of human services and OHA. The reality is we need to get more detail and understand what the actual impacts of these are. We need to make wiser decisions, and we need to understand that for everything that we want to add, something has to go away. And we need to make better decisions than we've been making. I'll leave it with that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the two presidents here in a second. I know you have to go back to your committee soon, Senator Devlin, but I guess I just wanted to, I think every level of our educational system, from early learning through postgraduate, is underfunded. I give you that. But there used to be a time back prior to 1993 where local voters funded the majority of K through 12 education and community colleges. And it was up to the legislature to take care of state police, universities, prisons. And that shifted when local voters said, we don't want to do it anymore. And so I'm just wondering what you have to say to that in terms of setting it, a rate, whether you call it a ceiling or a floor, and why that makes sense given Oregon's history.
Well, I will tell you, obviously, that many of us will probably discuss and lament the passage of Measure 5. But the reality is that's almost a historical event and probably will not change. Prior to Measure 5, although many of us live in areas that where we enjoyed school districts that were well-funded, there were very, very significant, and there still are to some degree, differences between haves and have-nots in the state. Tremendous differences between one of my school districts, like Oswego and the Umatilla School District. You would have seen a vast difference. I do think it's a problem that it's actually taken a lot of this discussion out of the local area. In fact, if I tried to make the connection with what I've just told you, we've taken away that discussion at the local area, and we're not really having it here. So in a sense, we're not really realizing the full impact of what's being done. The other thing is, even though, I won't go on any much farther, but I'm sort of a student of state budget history, maybe not a student of much history beyond that, but of state budget history. We did a terrible job prior to Measure 5 of funding K through 12. What we basically did is each time the voters disapproved a measure that was similar to 5, we further reduced K through 12 funding and led to higher property taxes, which ultimately led to the passage of Measure 5. I think there are a lot of problems with our system, but I think the reality is we may have been given the responsibility without all the tools that were necessary to fulfill that responsibility, but nonetheless, the responsibility is still ours.
Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator, for the detail. You've done an excellent job of describing the consequences, but if you were to very briefly describe the problem and solutions, where would you wish the legislature to go?
Well, I wish the legislature would not necessarily put things into silos, because I know some people will accuse me of doing that by even mentioning a percentage. But I would hope that they would start to understand the ramifications when they add something here, that it takes away something elsewhere. As the economy improves, we can start to make some reinvestments in education, and I think we can still meet our needs in public safety and our needs in human service. It's going to take a lot of difficult choices. Can we get anywhere close to what some people think is the ideal? I will tell you, although I sometimes get accolades for being an education funding supporter, I do not when I refer to the quality education model. The quality education model is a very good tool in terms of determining what you would need to do to improve, it's not the only one, but to improve K through 12 education. But the number that you would yield from that model would not be achievable in our economy regardless of how you revised the revenue system. And I would have my doubts, even if you revise the revenue system and you improve the economy substantially, whether you would ever get to those numbers. I think we just have to make better investments. I think we have to look at this more closely than we've ever looked at it before. And I think it's possible to do, but it's going to take a lot of work. I should say that President Pohm and President Ray here, it's away from your issue, Senator Morrison, Mr. Chairman, but I've always used this adage that the reason we no longer list the community college funding or the higher ed funding on our one pager of the budget is it would be embarrassing. They've been around the same range now for over a decade. They just don't stay at any one point. They go down below it. You were at 500 at one time. You're now at 395. You know, I think you'll do well in the next biennium. You'll get back up to maybe 440 or 450 under the current scenarios if we keep our current practices. You were at over 800. You might be back to 720 if we kept our current practices. If we didn't, we could get them back up to maybe 475, 500, not have to raise tuition as much. We should be able to get higher education back to 750, 775. Should be possible within the resources we have if we make the wise choices. Basically, we're going to try to get them back to about 2007 funding levels if we make a lot of hard, difficult choices in the next biennium.
Mr. Chair, my question was driven more to systemic solutions, and this is not the time to address it. But if you take the symptoms, which we're talking about, of a structural problem, it begs systemic solutions, and we as a legislature continue to dodge and dodge and dodge.
Well, if I might comment very quickly, Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, I do believe that there are some of those things out there that will change K through 12. Regardless of what anybody believes, I actually am a supporter of distance learning and actually am a supporter for some students of virtual schools and do believe that charter schools in some cases have had very good results. But those make up, even in your best of worlds, only about 5% of student attendance is about as high as you would get in that area. Systemic changes is, I think, where you'd have to look at the other 95%. And, I mean, clearly here, community colleges, we've tried to do a lot of things between community colleges and higher ed. But I think clearly we need to do more in terms of preparing people for actual employment, for jobs that are out there, while at the same time recognizing the benefits of a broad liberal arts education. But we don't do enough to prepare the people that we actually need. So.
You have our two distinguished presidents here.
I guess I'll...
Dr. Ray?
Well, first of all, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and to the committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to comment. A few comments on Senate Bill 1585. For the record, my name is Preston Pulliams. I'm District President for Portland Community College. The facts regarding Oregon Community College's enrollment and funding trends are very, very challenging. As the Senator just shared, as you all know, the support fund has decreased 20% over the last three biennia. Yet enrollment across community colleges has increased some 30% over the last 5 years as Oregonians flood to our institutions to in search of training that will give them a job or the first 2 years of a bachelor's degree. At Portland Community College alone, enrollment has increased since 2008 40% 40%. I thought that was a large number. 40%, I'm sorry. since 2008. This combination, the simultaneous increase in enrollment and the decline in the state funding, means the state funding per full-time equated student has decreased 42% over the last 5 years. This decline has resulted in two trends that pose a real danger for this state's future. First, colleges across the state have been forced to cut course offerings, eliminate training programs, etc. They have been forced to cut faculty, support staff. Colleges are increasingly unable to provide student support services needed for retention and completion. This fiscal year, Class of Community College eliminated one quarter of its full-time faculty positions, along with its criminal justice program. In the last 3 years, Southwestern Community College has cut 20% of its workforce and eliminated four programs, including human services and criminal justice. Blue Mountain Community College has cut one-third of its employees in the last 10 years. These examples are repeated again and again across 17 community colleges in the state of Oregon. In many of the rural areas and regions served by smaller colleges, we are at risk of cutting off the only opportunity for post-secondary education these Oregonians have. Second, we are saddling individual Oregonians with the primary responsibility of cost of their education. Because of state funding cuts, colleges have been forced to raise tuition by 19% since the recession began. At our college, Portland Community College, our students now pay 50% of the cost of their education through tuition. 6 years ago, it was 38%. Financial need is the number one reason our students at Portland Community College withdraw from college. The number of students applying for financial aid at Portland Community College grew by 75% between 2007 and 8 and 2009 and 10. One of the largest increases, percentage increases among colleges and universities across the country. But the financial aid is simply not keeping up. The only recourse students have, especially in our job-challenged economy, is to go into debt via student loans. In areas like career technical programs, continued cuts will mean students may end up with more college debt than is reasonable for careers they're seeking. Higher loans threaten to become the next major debt crisis in our country. For the first time, our younger generation is less educated than the older generation. I know you certainly want to reverse this trend. The legislature has adopted ambitious goals to dramatically increase educational attainment for our residents. However, without additional funding for colleges, community colleges, we will not be able to maintain the current level of educational attainment in our state, much less increase it. More than half of Oregon's projected job openings will demand post-secondary education. Oregonians will not be performing those jobs, earning those wages, and paying those taxes if we do not prioritize education funding and ensure it does not continue to decline. At Portland Community College, we're celebrating a historic birthday for this year, our 50th anniversary. For 50 years, we have been providing educational, economic opportunity for our residents in the Portland metro area. Our commitment to our students is represented in our message, opportunity, then, now, and always. Unfortunately, in Oregon, we're at the risk of not being able to fulfill that always promise. Senate Bill 1585 will help ensure community colleges across the state will be always be able to provide critical educational and training opportunities to our citizens in the coming years. Again, thank you for this opportunity for this brief comments.
Thank you. President Ray.
Thank you, Chairman Hass, members of the committee. I'm Ed Ray, president of Oregon State University, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about Senate Bill 1585. As you know, the bill asks future legislatures to commit to maintaining 50% of the budget that gets allocated to all levels of education. I think that's certainly something you could understand that all of us in all aspects of education supporting, but I think the argument for making that request of this legislature and into the future is particularly compelling when you think about the fact that we're engaged now in a grand experiment to see to what extent we can create as seamless as possible an education continuum from P to 20. And you'll forgive me if I observe as an economist that resources often have a lot to do with whether or not one can realize their aspirations. And it's really the first point I want to make is about the disconnect between where we are and our aspirations. Last session, the legislature adopted the goal of 40-40-20 for all of education by 2025, and it was in response, as President Pulliam's indicated, to the fact that we are in the process of providing a next generation to the workforce that for the first time in our history is less well-educated than the generations that came before them. And so one could easily observe that as people retire today, in this global economy, we are literally dumbing down the workforce here in Oregon. A very sad state of affairs, and certainly something that 40-40-20 is intended to address. But the graph that I've provided to you, and hopefully you've had a little bit of a chance to look at, takes the reductions in funding for higher education, public funding for higher education, from 1980 and simply follows out the trends for the country as a whole and for the for each of the individual states. And what you observe is that for the United States as a whole, given the trends since 1980, we will literally have no public funding on average for higher education in the United States by 2059. If you look at the individual state statistics, what you observe is that Oregon is the ninth fastest to zero among all of the states. We get there in 2036, 11 years after supposedly achieving 40-40-20. Well, again, I think the juxtaposition drives home the point that we have to be as purposeful with our resources as we are with our intentions about what we hope to achieve through our support for education. I could give you many other statistics. I've got a one pager here that looks at what's happened to Oregon State University. The story is the same as for all the community colleges and each of the public universities. In 2001-2, we had 18,000 students. Now we have 25,000 students. The state cell for general funding went from $88 million to $55 million. State general funding per student, per resident Oregonian student, fell from $6,209 to $3,158. Part of why I'm very pleased to support this legislation is not out of naivete. I understand that you can no more bind the next legislature than the last could you in terms of the decisions you have to make. Every legislative session, you have tough choices to make, and applying simple formulas or percentages simply can't be assured given the uncertainties that we face going forward. But sending that message, think hard about what you're doing. Do you really want to go below 50%? Do you want to keep heading toward 2036 when there's no public funding of higher education? Does this make any sense given the commitment that was made to try to achieve 40-40-20 by 2025? I think having that message codified in this bill hopefully is a good way to remind legislators in the future that it's one thing to talk about commitments, and it's another thing to live up to them and to make the hard choices that make our aspirations possible. So I'll stop there, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, both presidents. This is probably a larger discussion, obviously, than this bill, but you both referenced previous generations, and I was phone banking for the Beaverton bond measure last fall and had a lady on the phone who said she's going to vote no, her kids are already through school. And we got into this debate about, well, that's not how the deal works.
Yeah.
That We go generation to generation, and down the road, it's not just about your kids. It's about how we all succeed when others succeed, and everybody ultimately is better off when the success of the generation before is greater. Anyway, I guess my point is it's not really just the legislature here that needs to be involved in this discussion as much as it is maybe a cultural shift where we recognize that someone else's success, when someone else succeeds, we all succeed, and that will represent a different way of doing things and likely a bigger investment than we've been making in something as critical as education at all levels.
Did you have a question, Senator Steiner?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's, to be honest, it's more of a rhetorical one, which I try to avoid. But I think it's valid, and it follows pretty closely to what Chair Haas said. 50% is great. I mean, as a bare minimum, cool. But the problem is, if the total revenues go down, then 50% becomes an increasingly smaller number, right? It's a percentage. It's not an absolute number. So the rhetorical question I would ask, and that I would ask you to take back to everybody you talk to, as I will be doing, is, okay, people, you stand out there on the steps of the Capitol, and you tell us you want us to fund education better. I do. I'm desperately eager to do that, to fund education where it needs to be, to provide for a future. But just like the woman Senator Haas spoke with, where is the communal responsibility? How are we going to find the funds to do this? Because 50% of less is a lot less. And I don't think really expect you to have an answer. I almost never would ask a question or make a statement like this. But it's bugging the heck out of me, to be blunt.
Mr. Chairman, can I answer a rhetorical question?
I'd be surprised if you didn't.
Thank you, Senator Devlin.
The 50% is a floor. And regardless of how slow this recovery is, in the long term, our revenue is actually not declining in the long term. What I'm basically trying to say here is unless we can hold it at least at this percentage of revenue, if you drop to 47, which is very possible, actually, when you look at the numbers we're looking at, if you drop to 47 in the next biennium, it will be just that much harder to have any reality between our rhetoric on education and what we're actually able to fund at that level. 3% then will be roughly $450 million that will be going elsewhere.
Senator Beyer?
I think we're talking about the real problem today, and that's the disinvestment in education. And moving forward, and I've grown somewhat fond, although I shouldn't set that way, of saying that my generation, your generation, gentlemen, our parents took care of us very, very well, and we dropped the ball completely. And you know, we got everything, and our generation seems to be unwilling to fund the same level for our children and our grandchildren. That's just a reality. But I think we need to look at this in some different ways. That old worn-out look outside the box little thing. But I was intrigued by some of the discussions that have been going on. I've always thought that if we were going to do the kind of thing that Senator Devlin is proposing here, what we really need is a funding proposal that's locked in the Constitution that doesn't just talk about existing money, but talks about dedicating a stream of money to education. I think that might have a chance of passing. And there are other ways. Other countries are looking at this in different ways. And I was intrigued by a discussion coming out of the state of California last week where they were actually talking about putting a proposal together that would say to the California student, you don't have to pay anything for your education up front, but you sign a contract that for the next 20 years, 5% of your income, whatever that is, will be returned to an education fund. I know some foreign countries are doing something similar to that, but I think that's the kind of thing we have to start looking at in different ways. Certainly, all the while I've been involved in or around the legislature, I think we've been on the wrong track. We've been disinvesting, and we need to turn that around.
Can I? Chairman Haas, Senator Beyer, my aspirations for you are actually much less grand. If you can hold the line, I will be impressed. When I first came here, I told my colleagues at Oregon State that whatever our aspirations are for that institution, the state is not the answer. It will never be the answer. We have to grow and diversify our sources of revenue, manage our costs, and make tough strategic investments of existing resources. What I like about this bill is it tries to draw a line in the sand and say, you know, can we at least try to do something? And you're right, a declining number, a percent, fixed percentage of a declining number is a smaller number, but maybe it helps stay the speed with which we run toward 2036. So maybe a more modest hope is we can begin a conversation that says, can we staunch the bleeding? Can we stop at this point and agree we need to look, as you suggested, as Senator Morse has suggested, other ways to get us to a better place? And while we're trying to figure out how to do that, how to get people, our constituents, to listen to us so we're empowered to do it, can we at least say no more? Let's hold the line here. Let's rely on the school systems, the community colleges, the universities to use their wits to make the most of what we are capable of giving them at this fixed percentage until we can all figure out how to get to a better place. I'm willing to step up and do everything I can if I can get you to just hold the line in terms of where that funding is while I invent with my colleagues some ways to do other things that will get us to a position where we can educate more Oregonians for whatever level of resources we have.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond also in reaction in terms of a couple of things. One, in terms of the statement about my kids have made it and so everybody else should be in their own, I've done my job. I mean, we all know that it's all about economic development. It's all about good communities. It's all about a better society. I mean, it's bigger than that. I get calls every week from employers who are hiring in these tough economic times. But there's not enough educated students in the pipeline to fill those kinds of skills that they need. I think that's the tragedy of this whole thing in terms of high unemployment rate, but there are jobs out there. We need to invest in that. I see it very simply as, since arriving here 8 years ago, and I enjoy my tenure here. I enjoy, again, working as head of Portland Community College and working in the state. It's a great state. But there's a promise around this state that, if you do the wrong thing, we've got a prison or jail cell for you. I'd like to see us reach the point or figure out a way that if you do the right things, if you stay in school, if you finish high school, we got a quality higher education for you. So it's just that basic to me.
Thank you. Senator Morton.
Thank you. By the way, Norway has the policy that Senator Beyer indicated. They have a very strong natural resource base, and they're cash rich in their country. But my question, Senator Devlin, in looking forward, if we were to adopt this 50% policy, and then looking forward to the ramifications of the Affordable Care Act and the expansion of that Medicaid safety net, to another 250,000 lives. My understanding is that there would be some hope and a prayer that the federal government will, as that expansion occurs in eligibility, that there would be some assistance in that, but eventually it goes away. What do we do in those kinds of circumstances? And I'm very concerned about this very issue of the allocation of these resources, and you see the human services in real dollars, you said 64% jump. What are we going to do in the future?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse. I think the reality is in human services, particularly in healthcare, that I compare healthcare in human services the same way that I compare K through 12 in education or corrections in public safety. They're all good, to be quite honest. But people used to tell me there was an 800-pound gorilla in the legislature, and they used to say it was K-12, and I said it's not. It's K-12 in education, it's corrections in public safety, and it's health care and human services. I think that the direction that we have went is the best direction that we can go for now, regardless of what happens with federal health care reforms, because some way we need to get the cost of health care under control. But we've actually shared this discussion, and I'll tell you what my concerns are. We might get the first $500 million. We might. Hope we do. But obviously, we are counting on a federal health care reform package that does not necessarily have the support of Congress at this time and may not have the support of Congress after the next election, or maybe even the support of the chief executive after the next election. If they do not make the appropriations that are necessary to add in that new influx of people into the program, I would hope that at least they would take away the requirement to bring those people into the program, because the funding would literally devastate budget without that funding. The other issue that's there that I think many of you are aware of is we made a conscious decision back in 2003 to take the standard population off the general fund because we could not afford them, to be just perfectly blunt. And I think that was a logical decision. It created massive problems for health care when we did that. The only way we brought them back was first through MUPL, then through provider taxes. But the reality is, unless we get some substantial increase in federal funding in health care, we will not be able to bring that new group of population on. And we've had this discussion too. I mean, I'm a realist. I don't even know what the current number is now. It's either $1.4 trillion a year in deficits at the federal level. I do not know realistically how they will be able to appropriate at the numbers that they would need to appropriate to fund those new additions to the Medicaid population, given what our current fiscal picture is on the federal level.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Presidents, for
coming
down here and leaving your institutions today.
Thank
you, Senator Devlin, for coming down here from your office up the hall. We have some educators here that are going to speak on this bill, Senate Bill 1585, which sets a 50% floor ceiling for educational spending. And I have Lisa Fragola. And do you have some other members of your team?
I think it's just me.
Okay.
Okay.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Lisa Fragola, and I'm a second grade teacher in Eugene, Oregon, and I'm a member of the Eugene Education Association and the Oregon Education Association. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. I think we just heard a lot of information about the statistics and the percentage of cuts and the drain of money and funds that have occurred in our public schools. I feel very confident that you are all well informed regarding that information. What I would like to talk with you about is, what does that look like in a classroom on a day-to-day basis as an elementary educator with the children that I work with? When I started teaching in the building that I'm currently in about 6 to 7 years ago, if I had a class that was 22 students, I thought that was quite large. I started as a kindergarten teacher. I started the school year with 32 students in my class.
What school?
Edison Elementary in Eugene. And I happen to know that right in the middle of last week, we had a family register. I probably will be going back to school tomorrow to figure out where I can add another desk in my classroom. If you walked into my classroom, you would see a sea of desks. There's about 2 feet all the way around, all these little islands of desks around my classroom for me to walk and for 32 young minds to move around the classroom. On a personal basis, I spend a lot of time getting stepped on and bumped into. And for them, it, you know, if you can imagine being in a room with that many little ones, I don't know how much time you spend with kids, but it's hard for many of them to stay focused on the learning that they need to do. And for those students that are most significantly challenged, it's increasingly hard. My school previously had the benefit of having much greater support in our classrooms. Actually, last year, out of in a district that has about 20 elementary schools, every school in elementary school in our district had music and or PE. I think that there are only two elementary schools at this point in our district that have music and or PE. And the reduction of support that we see in the classroom has been significant as well. Again, when I first started as a second grade teacher, I would have an instructional assistant in my classroom to help with reading instruction, and I might have three groups running in my classroom at the same time with, you know, six or seven students in each group. Now I have two groups running in my classroom that have 10 or 15 children in them each. I simply cannot provide the support to the children in my class that need it. And I am seeing my students, some of them not make the progress that they deserve to be making, and many of them falling farther behind because they don't have the attention that I so desperately want to be able to give them. I can count numerous moments during the day when I'll look up and look around my room and think about, oh my goodness, did I even have a chance to talk to Simone today? Did I even have a chance to check in with Rudolfo concerning how his writing is going? And it's really frustrating to me as an educator who cares really deeply about the children that I work with to stop in the middle of the day and have that realization that I'm failing my students, that I'm failing the families that I work with, no matter how hard I try. I get to school each morning often at 6 or 6:30 a.m., I'm often there till 5 each day, and when that bell rings at 8:05, my day starts, and I am in constant contact with my children all the way until they leave. You know, there are some things that we laugh about in regard to that. I don't get to go to the bathroom all day, and, you know, educators laugh about that, but it's a reality of my day. I take my lunch in the classroom with my children, with my students, and that is what my day looks like on a day-to-day basis. And by Friday, it's really challenging to have the attention that these children deserve and need. I really would love to see education funded in this state so that our children are successful. I know each of you would really like that as well. And I know we're facing really challenging times, but I would just like for you to hear what it's like on the front lines, that I feel like we are not meeting the educational needs of our students, and that any type of reform is not going to make a difference if we don't fund it. We need to fund whatever approaches that we choose to make to education so that our students can be successful. I would also like to add, since a friend of mine who is also an educator could not be here today, a bit of a perspective from what it's like at secondary ed. He is a physics teacher in one of our high schools, and he has about 30 chairs in his classroom. He has 42 to 50 students on a regular basis in his class, and children sit on the floor, they sit on the heaters. He can't even imagine giving the students the support that they need. And by the time he sees these children, you know, these are the kids that already are feeling successful in school, many of them. And I can't even imagine the students who don't feel successful in school, how it must feel for them to go into a classroom with those type of learning environments. So I hope I've been able to give you a little bit of a perspective. I don't feel that it is that you don't have a perspective about what's happening, but I feel like as our elected officials that you do care deeply about students in Oregon, and you care deeply about our schools being successful. And I've heard some of you comment about how we need to be creating a vision within Oregon and our communities. But I guess what I would like to say to you today is that you, as our elected officials, you are our leaders, and that we need for you to have a voice for our children. And I hope that maybe you'll remember one thing that I said today about the children that I work with, and that they deserve a better education. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh.
Any questions?
Just a thanks, if I could, to you for your dedication and commitment, both to your students and taking the time to come down here and speak with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate what you do.
Thank you.
Any other educators here today who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 1585?
Gentlemen of the back.
Yes, come on.
Hi.
We pulled out the sign-up sheets maybe too early.
No, you didn't. I didn't sign it. But your question was, were there any other educators who wanted to speak? So I took advantage of that. Thanks for hearing me. My name is Steve Frank, and I'm a substitute teacher. I was a full-time teacher for a couple years, many years ago in Valsetts, Oregon, if any of you remember Valsetts. Seeing some head shaking. I have a little darling in the back who's in first grade now, who came with me today. I thought it would be great for her to see what goes on in the legislature. And it's simple. This is basically a stopgap measure. It's to make sure things don't get any worse than they could possibly get. It's a kind of a safety, a little bit of a safety net. And this bill makes sense. And I won't belabor the point.
Thank you. Your name for the record?
Your name.
Oh, Steve Frank. I said it at the beginning, but I'll repeat it.
Sorry.
Good afternoon. I'm Karen Stratton. I'm from Senator Haas's district. I came down to talk to him and go to the rally. I teach school in Beaverton at Sexton Mountain Elementary. I've taught fourth and fifth grade there since 2004. As the first speaker said, you know, just in 8 years, I've seen so much taken away from our schools. My own kids have been in Beaverton School since 1991. My oldest son had the privilege of starting school just when Measure 5 hit. So I've seen it all, and what we're facing right now in Beaverton, I'm sure you've heard the numbers, $40 million in cuts after over $105 million that's been cut in the last 4 years. And the school district is asking the teachers to spend our after-school time to figure out how should we make those cuts. And I just can't imagine the impact that that's going to have on our morale, because it's hard enough to come to school every day and face 29 or 30 or 31 students in your fourth grade classroom and try to meet all those different needs. And then to keep your morale up for the kids while you're being asked, well, how many of our fellow teachers and educational support professionals should be cut, or how many days should we go without next year? That's the reality that I live with. And I I got to tell you, I'm really discouraged, and I hope that you'll do everything that you can do to continue to increase the funding for our schools. There's not a whole lot we can do without the money that allows us to be there. All the education reform ideas are great, but they're just ideas if there's no money behind it. Thank you.
Any questions for me?
Appreciate your input. Thank you. And your dedication.
Okay. That's everyone on 1585. I have on. We're in simultaneous public hearings on Senate Bill 413, Senate Bill 414, and Senate Bill 415. House Bill 4013, 4014, 4015. And on 4013, I have Jim King, Matt Markey, Autumn Wilbur. Jim, why don't you start us off?
Thank you. I'm Mohan Jim King. I was 23 years at Chemeketa and 6 years at Western and 2 years in the Peace Corps, and had an awful experience in South Salem High School, but that's another story. I'll be back to talk about Stewards of Children as probably the best way to deal with child sex abuse, because that's a standard that I think we're going to hold your feet to the fire on, not in any way that's a threat here. I just want to work with OEA and COSA and the State Board to bring you a comprehensive bill to address that, because teachers are now the most important contact person. Kids who have been abused have in the past gone to parents a little bit more frequently than teachers. Now teachers are the most frequent first contact, and that turns out to be most significant in terms of the trauma they experience. But let me just tell you a little bit on 13 and 14, because I'm sort of misusing my privileges, but it speaks to best practices. When I was at Chemeketa, one of the things I did is I took a sabbatical and looked at best practices in community college education. My classes had gone from 20, 25, 30, 40, 45 because I was good. I won the teacher a year award 1 year. And I went from standard kind of small group stuff to learning teams and so forth and so on. The best practices that I looked at was, what do foreign language teachers do that's so substantially different? If you look at minutes of contact with learners, their techniques are drastically different. Now, that's a different use of the word, the term accelerated learning. But they use music, breaks every 20 minutes, very visual, movement. It's an amazing operation. So I spent 6 months going around the country and looking at accelerated learning, if you define it that way. Now, I know that's not what you're looking at. But if we look at efficiencies, large classrooms, we better train teachers, because I did that at Western for 6 years, a very innovative program that turned out Oregon's first bilingual teachers. We're going to have to teach teachers to use learning groups and some very different strategies like some of the foreign language teachers do. I'm not prepared. I wasn't expecting to give this testimony. My email was just full this morning with saying they're dealing with accelerated learning. I know that that's not exactly what you have in mind with this bill, but it's worth looking at. If you want to look at efficiencies, and that's maybe where we need to go, accelerated learning is an interesting field. Learning to learn is an interesting field where you can train kids to be highly efficient learners. So there are some things I'd love to come back and talk to you about. My primary concern will be coming back as a lobbyist with the Darkness to Light Foundation looking at child sex abuse prevention. One in four girls will be sexually abused for their 18. One in six boys. That's where we are. If you look at budgets in social services, law enforcement, those services that are holding line, if that's acceptable, it's not. So I hope like heck we can come back and present you with an option for Oregon like South Carolina has, where they have many of their teachers prepared in this Stewards of Children program. We can at least hold the line, maybe make some improvement on that. But that's the standard I'm going to come back with, not these charts about higher ed funding and so forth. What are we doing with the most vulnerable? Domestic violence and children. And we better look at those numbers hard. I'll be back some other time. Appreciate your time.
Good, thanks.
Questions? I'd be happy to... will something that was a little something very different. But thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, testifying in support of House Bill 4013, representing the College Board today. The bill as drafted is an attempt to help high schools in our state that aren't offering accelerated classes or few accelerated classes like AP and IB. The bill would have the Department of Education share with these school districts the available resources and different means that are available to them to help these schools offer these types of classes. Mr. Chair, with your help, last session a bill was passed that would require by 2014 all high schools in Oregon to offer accelerated classes in math, English, and science. And unfortunately, there are a lot of high schools in our state that frankly just don't offer any of these types of classes. So this bill is kind of a best practices in a sense of how to help bridge that gap for those districts that aren't offering these types of programs. In an effort to keep the fiscal down in this particular piece of legislation, what we did was we were encouraging the entities that create these types of classes to supply data to the Department of Education. So in the case of AP, the College Board, my client, would turn over data to the Department of Education to show how many high schools are offering AP classes and how many aren't. The department would then take that information and start to share this information back with those school districts. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. The reference to advanced placement was removed in the previous iteration.
Yes, correct, Mr. Chair. The original bill referenced advanced placement specifically. We worked with the House, and part of the reason for that was it was taken from some legislation that passed in California as a model. And so what we did in this legislation was we created the definition of accelerated learning options and actually leave that up to the Department of the State Board of Education to, by rule, adopt a definition to that. But it does not specifically state any certain entity, and I think it would include all of those types of classes similar to your legislation from last session.
Okay. I've got you signed up as opposing this bill.
Then I marked the wrong box. I apologize.
Thank you. That eliminates some confusion or some dissonance. Okay. Any questions?
Thank you.
We have some others to testify on that. We're in a simultaneous public hearing. So we're going to move to House Bill 4015 here. Recognize Representative Conger and Administrator Cox, if you could give us a brief summary.
4015. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 4015 requires Oregon Health Authority to develop and maintain a lead poisoning prevention clearinghouse on its website. Specifies information that must be included in lead poisoning prevention clearinghouse. There was no amendment on the House side. It passed out of the committee 8-0 and passed the House 59-0 with one excused.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Jason Conger, representing House District 54. And just really a quick introduction to House Bill 4015. First of all, I want to thank you for hearing it. And I hope that you can work it quickly. And we just wanted to give a little bit of a sense of the work that went into it. We, during the interim, put together kind of a House Education Committee work group and were, I think, successful in coming to consensus on the provisions that you see before you. If there was any objection to this bill, it was probably that it didn't do enough to deal with potential lead hazards in schools. And but I view this as a very good first step and one that we can do using a lot of existing resources, thus the no fiscal impact. I have had in my family the experience of actually having a child test falsely positive for very severe lead poisoning in the state of Massachusetts. My daughter Madison was an infant at the time, and they do a surface skin finger prick blood test, and which picks up lead that's on the surface of the skin as well as the lead that comes out in the blood sometimes. And when that happened, we became aware sort of the hard way of the hazard that lead poses, particularly to small children, to development, kids who are developing. And it's very severe. It's a potent neurotoxin. We think, or I thought before that happened, that this was a hazard that probably didn't exist anymore, because we have gone a long way toward not using lead in things like paint on houses, and we've made a lot of advances. We don't use leaded gasoline the way that we did when I was a kid, and other things. But it still exists. Not only is it in the environment, it's in our housing, in older housing stock, and it's also in our older government buildings, including schools. And so the idea here, very simply put, is to take information that the Oregon Health Authority is already collecting, already has access to, put it in one place, kind of an online clearinghouse, where schools and particularly maintenance staff at schools can go and can look and become aware, educate themselves about what to look for, to identify potential hazards, and if they find that there may be a hazard, what they can do to get it tested and to get it cleaned up. It's not rocket science. It can be done, and hopefully this can go one small step toward providing some additional protection to kids who are in older schools that may still have lead paint or lead substances around, specifically lead paint. So passed the House unanimously, and again, appreciate very much your time and attention. I hope you'll work this bill, and be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Sure. So a year or two from now, what does this look like?
What will be the result of the bill?
Yeah. So what's a home run for you on this bill?
A home run on this bill would be if the Oregon Health Authority begins the process by putting up the website, starts to link to other resources that are available now and freely available, and if schools will engage, take a look at the information that's on the website, and take steps to educate their maintenance staff, really is what I think you'd want to target, to look for the potential hazards. There are signs that you can look for, aging in the paint and things like that, and having that knowledge, first of all, to recognize the potential hazard would be step one. That'd be a single. Stand-up double would be that they then know how to clean it up, if they find out that there's a potential hazard there. And then a home run would be that they recognize the hazard, test for it, and clean it up, and no kids come into contact with the lead dust. So the problem with the lead dust is that if you don't know what to look for, which we didn't in the home that we were living in Massachusetts, it is completely invisible. You have no idea. And as a parent, of course, you know that you want to protect your kids. And having something that can damage them for life, for the rest of their life, that you can't see and you don't know is present is really alarming. So a home run would be that the health authority does the job of pulling the information together, makes it user-friendly, and that schools access it, train themselves, and prevent the hazard.
Dr. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Congress, we haven't actually had a chance to meet yet, so thank you. As a family physician, I'm all too acutely aware of the concerns that you raise about lead poisoning in our youngest, most vulnerable Oregonians and across the state. I'm actually from Massachusetts originally. I guess the only thing that concerned me about what you just said was the idea of having the maintenance staff clean it up. Cleaning up lead is actually a fairly specialized job, and it requires actually certification, I believe, by the health authority or maybe by the board of contractors, I can't remember whom, but there are people who are authorized to do it. And expecting maintenance staff in schools across the state to be effective at doing this without causing contamination more widely distributed, I guess, concerns me a little bit. Maybe I misunderstood what you said.
No, you raise a really good point, and I appreciate the question, first of all, and so let me clarify. The certification process you're talking about, I know of one for sure that is Construction Contractors Board requirement to do lead cleanups. And when you're talking about renovation or remediation, then you need that certification because you are releasing the lead. And so part of, I guess, if I would have been clearer the first time, what I would have said is that the staff would know who to call if they have to do a remediation. But there are cleaning techniques, just mopping and, certain things that you can do that will actually have the effect of reducing the likelihood that lead dust will accumulate in certain spots. And there are places where you can, it's, again, without doing the remediation, without releasing the lead into the atmosphere or into the environment, you can have a higher likelihood of preventing that hazard from accumulating in areas that are more likely for the lead dust to accumulate.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Do you have any sense at this point what percentage of schools in Oregon may be affected by this problem?
I don't. I'm not sure that there's any data that shows the original age of any standing structures. So you would, if you're going to collect that data, and I don't think we have it, if you're going to collect that data, you need to look at when the school was originally constructed, not the most recent renovation efforts, unless they included a cleanup. And so are there buildings in our school system that are old enough that they could contain lead? The answer is yes. Do we know which ones actually contain potential lead hazards? The answer, so far as I can tell, is no.
I have to admit to finding myself a little torn at this point about this bill. Obviously, anything we can do to reduce lead exposure to children is high on my list of good things to do.
Right.
And yet, I find myself worrying about the fiscal impact of this. I don't know with whom you've spoken at OHA about how much it's going to cost them to do this. I don't know where we expect schools, given everything we've heard, to find the funds to mitigate these problems without cutting other services. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't want toxins in my school. If I have to choose between toxins and music, I guess I'd get the toxins out first, but that wouldn't be a pleasant choice to make. And, on the beginning, on the get-go, this is a pretty straightforward, let's put it on the website, but it sounds as if it's trying to get a lot more expansive. And as a parent, I mean, we have money, for example, for seismic upgrades. There's a bill coming to your side of the building from President Courtney about what's the name of the agency? I keep forgetting.
Dogami,
thank you. I'm still learning. Dogami required to post information about seismic risk of our schools. But we know that there's money available. There's bond money available to pay for seismic upgrades to our school. Mm-hmm. We don't have similar funding to pay for lead mitigation in our schools. And I'm rambling a bit, but I wonder if you've thought about the sort of long-term ramifications of this in that regard.
Senator, I have thought about it, and we discussed it at length in the work group. And in fact, the original proposal, which was brought by a lady who whose kids had suffered lead poisoning, and she's a very, very persuasive advocate for this on this issue. And the concern obviously came up that there's a cost associated with remediating lead, and it's not always necessary. That's the other part of this. You know, having lived in Massachusetts, many, many buildings, many residences have lead-based paint in them. Right. And if they're properly sealed and if they're watched to make sure that they stay properly sealed, then there really isn't a problem.
Right.
And so the idea here was to be more educational and to take resources, again, that we already have or that we can access basically for free. I mean, OHA is in the process of redoing their website anyway. And so this is taking information they already have available. They can put it in one place, make this clearinghouse. And so there is no cost to that. And if a school were to find that they had lead contamination, I think the bottom line is we have to bear the cost to clean it up, because you can't have that neurotoxin being ingested, poisoning kids. That's unlikely to happen very often, and I think maybe ever. The idea is just to watch for it. The idea is to know what to do if you see it. It is not to drive a remediation program at this time. There's nothing in this bill that should be interpreted that way. This is just to get information up so that people know what to look for, and can have a sort of a plan of action if they see something that could be a hazard to deal with it. And that's it.
Thank you. Thanks for your patience with the questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Representative, thank you very much for your work on this.
Appreciate your time.
All right, we're in a
simultaneous public hearing on House Bills 4013, 4014, and 4015. It's kind of our version of three-dimensional chess up here. So we'll go back to House Bill 4013. Autumn Wilburn, did you want to testify from the department on accelerated learning?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for giving me time to speak today. For the record, Autumn Wilburn, Oregon Department of Education. I just wanted to point out a few additional things about the bill. Here in Oregon, we have three strong accelerated learning programs, advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and dual credit. And the language in this bill does ensure that all of those advanced learning options will be publicized, and then hopefully we will see some increases in participation in all three of them. I wanted to say thank you to the House Education Committee and to representatives from the College Board for working with the department on the language to ensure that all programs were covered and not just one or another. So I think that gets at some of the questions that you were asking earlier. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Questions of Autumn? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll move to House Bill 4014. And let's call up Cindy Hunt, Tricia Yates, and Emma Colbert.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Cindy Hunt, Government and Legal Affairs Manager for the Department of Education. First of all, with House Bill 4014, A Engrossed, I'd like to put it in context. It's the next step in mandate relief. Some of you may recall last session that this committee specifically passed three bills that were in this effort around mandate relief, Senate Bill 826 and 560. So House Bill 4014, whereas Senate Bill 800 was kind of the low-hanging fruit, 4014 is moving up the tree. And what you'll have in front of you is a summary of the mandate relief thus far that the department's been engaged with in partnership with our friends at OSBA sitting here, COSA, OEA, OSCA, AFT, OEA, OAESD, that's an alphabet full, Governor's Office, the State Board of Ed, and of course the legislature. So I wanted to put it in context for you because 4014 in and of itself is only an additional 10 mandates. But there are some cost savings. And so now, I think it was on page 3 of the materials I handed out, I've outlined all 10 of the mandates that are in 4014. The House Education Committee pulled out a couple, but they put in a couple as well. So the first one in 4014 is the elimination of the District Best Business Practices Advisory Committee. And this is a mandate in which the Department of Ed is allowed to expend up to $800,000 each biennium on this. It was suspended for this biennium, but next biennium it would kick in again. The $800,000, because we're not doing this activity this biennium, is being distributed to school districts through the state school fund currently for those things that you heard about, you know, earlier in some of the testimony here today. The next kind of mandate on the list is there was a requirement placed on the State Board of Education that when they receive an appeal of a charter school application, they were required to mediate that application between the charter applicant and the school board. Mediations in this area, I think there's been between 25 and 30 over the last 11 years, and we only know of two successful ones. The main reason for this, we believe, is by the time they get to the State Board of Ed, they're already pretty contentious with each other, to be honest. And so eliminating this requirement would not only save time from the districts and the applicants, but it would also save about $10,000 a year in mediation costs. So then going down the list, the next one is if a school district wishes to adopt a textbook that's not on the state adopted list, right now they're told they have to notify us We don't approve it or anything like that. They just notify us. So this has been eliminated, and what's put in its place is that we will adopt guidelines that districts would have to follow to adopt state textbooks. So things like textbooks have to meet state adopted standards, or, you know, they can't be discriminatory in their text, that kind of thing. The next two mandates were added by the House Education Committee. The first of those is to allow districts more flexibility in their class schedules throughout the year. The next was to eliminate a mandate that required certain districts to engage in certain types of student recognition. That's not to say that student recognition is a bad thing. It's just that, do we need to, at the minutia level, at the state level, be telling districts exactly what kind of student recognition they're to give? So again, this would give districts more flexibility. The next three mandates on the list are specifying a certain week of celebration in our schools. So it's Arbor Week, History of Oregon Week, and then the Women in History Week. With these, again, it's not a bad thing that we're celebrating this and we're in support of that, but it's very precise and very prescriptive. So going down the list, for example, the History of Oregon Statehood Week is on May 2nd. It's not on February 14th, corresponding with Oregon's birthday. There are many, when I asked Oregon's, you know, our history experts, they're like, yeah, well, we've heard from a lot of history teachers who would kind of like to celebrate it on Oregon's History Week, you know, on their birthday. So this would give them more flexibility. Again, it's not replacing it with a prohibition to celebrate Oregon history or to celebrate, you know, in a particular week. It's just giving them more flexibility. As far as Women in History Week goes, women's achievements and the achievement of other historical figures are part of our history standards that we just updated last year. So those standards aren't going away or aren't being amended by this. It's just the elimination of the very specific week. And again, those same history teachers, which I know this committee heard from previously on a different bill, you know, I think they would say that they like to incorporate this kind of thing throughout and weave it throughout the curriculum as opposed to just one day, 1 hour, etc. Going down the list, the next one is an elimination of a report to you, the legislature, on family life, HIV, and human sexuality. This report, I went back and asked our folks, well, how often has this report been asked for by the advocates in the last 10 years? None. So that's why it's on the list. Again, I'm not saying this report or this data isn't important, but it hasn't been asked for. And then finally, an elimination of the mandate to provide phonics instruction on our districts. And again, this would be something that districts could choose to do if they wanted to, but it wouldn't be mandatorily required. The people that previously spoke today can, I think, make a better argument for this bill than I could in that, you know, this bill isn't going to save millions of dollars. It's not. But, like I said, you know, a year ago, is that if each person had an idea that saved $10,000, $800,000, $5,000, and then you multiply that by 197 districts, then you do get to put more money into the classroom, like that teacher was saying, or you get smaller classes, and you're not doing some of the things on this list. And with that.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tricia Yates with the Oregon School Boards Association, representing the 1,400 volunteer elected directors in our K-12 community college and ESDs. Here in support of House Bill 4014, the next phase of mandate relief. We so appreciate the leadership on both sides of the aisle from this committee last session to pass two products of our collaborative mandate relief project that Ms. Hunt mentioned earlier. You passed Senate Bills 560 and 800, and those bills were applauded by the districts in the field. They really want to redirect their scarce resources away from reporting, reports that aren't used, and towards student achievement. I can tell you that each year the School Boards Association travels about 4,000 miles meeting with our members. And in Lake County, I know a small place in Lakeview, the superintendent's assistant spends half of her time on reporting to the state. And I think if we could look at the scarce resources we heard earlier through Senator Devlin's testimony and others and think about how the time is being used and the priority is really to educate our students, we'd say this is a great move. It's a modest list, but it sends a signal to districts across the state that you understand what they're up against. And we really urge you to follow your colleagues in the House who passed this bill unanimously and approve the next phase of mandate relief. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tricia. And thank you, Cindy. This is an excellent summary of these individual components of this bill. Any questions?
Thank you.
You both.
Thanks.
Emma Colburn, last call. Okay. We have gone through everyone who wants to testify on the four bills before us today. So I'll close a public hearing on Senate Bill 1585, House Bill 4013, 4014, and 4015. And I'll open up a work session on House Bill 4013, the Accelerated Learning Bill.
Are you ready, Mr. Chair?
Ready.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4013A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 4013A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 4013A moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator George is excused. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay. Close work session on House Bill 4013 and open up a work session on House Bill 4015 on lead poisoning.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4015A to the floor for the due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 40.
It's not A, I don't believe.
It did say
no,
A.
No, I don't think it was amended. Yes, it does. You're right.
Okay.
Okay.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 4015A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 4015 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Steiner Hayward, would you like to carry this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close work session on House Bill 4015. Wednesday is our final day of meeting. We will have a full agenda. We will carry over House Bill 4015 until Wednesday. 4014. Excuse me. We'll carry over 4014 and a few others on our list be added by the end of the day. We have no other business, so we are adjourned.